helping you to give a defense of Christ to your non-Christian neighbor. This is Apologetics Profile.
Welcome to The Profile. I'm Watchman Staff Apologist Daniel Ray, your host. Nice to have you along this week. A few episodes back on The Profile, we spoke with Elisa Childers and Tim Barnett about their new book, Deconstructing Christianity. Elisa and Tim took a deep dive into the popular cultural phenomenon of people leaving Christianity and posting their experiences in social media. Collectively, this informal movement has been called deconstruction. But this trend did not just pop out of nowhere. So for the next few episodes on The Profile, we will be exploring the historical and cultural roots of unbelief in the Christianized West. What are the intellectual foundations of atheism? From where did widespread disbelief emanate? What holds a culture together if it loses its theological moorings? What gives meaning to life? What is the cosmos, and what is my place within it? These questions continue to cause not a few problems for worldviews and beliefs which reject the existence of God. A common popular response to many of these questions boils down to, I don't know, and it doesn't really matter at this point. In one sense, the phenomenon of deconstruction has a kind of indifference to any particular objective truth about the nature of reality, but on the other hand, does make a few poignant truth claims about what deconstruction should be. For example, deconstructionists will often emphasize that one ought not to try and reconstruct any particular answers to life's biggest questions. According to deconstructionists, there is no particular destination for those exiting the church. In fact, there shouldn't be one. Don't worry if you don't know where you'll end up. Just so long as you are thoroughgoing in your public denunciation and tearing down of your former Christian faith. Over 2,000 years ago, the Greek philosopher Democritus proposed that everything in the known universe was made up of merely atoms and the void. No need to invoke the gods, everything could be explained in terms of purely physical causality. But lest you think this physicalist reduction of everything under and beyond the sun was merely the dream of clever Greek thinkers with too much time on their hands, think again. This impulse is central to postmodern philosophy today. The late postmodern philosopher Richard Rorty opined in 1979, for example, that, quote, every speech, thought, theory, poem, composition, and philosophy will turn out to be completely predictable in purely naturalistic terms. Some atoms and the void account of microprocesses within individual human beings will permit the prediction of every sound and inscription which will ever be uttered. There are no ghosts. End quote. In other words, Rorty is saying that everything we think, say, or believe is nothing but the motions of atoms in our minds, completely predictable in terms of computational algorithms. Though we presently have no access to such predictive prognostications, Rorty concedes, it doesn't matter, for such a foundational reality is, for him, truly poetic. But in shaping his atomistic reductionism, Rorty expresses a fear that if his atomist view of human thought is false, that this could lead to the possibility that, quote, there will be objectively true or false answers to every question we ask, so that human worth will consist in knowing truths, and human virtue will be merely justified true belief, end quote. Rorty's ideas here epitomize the often contrary assertions of postmodernism. On the one hand, Rorty loathes the idea of objective truth, but on the other, his objective truth about reality is that there is no such thing as objective truth, no such things as true or false answers to the questions we ask. But does Rorty intend that we objectively accept as true his claim that everything can be reduced to microprocesses of atoms in our brains? Does he want us to accept as objectively true that there are no ghosts, that is, no souls or no God? If Democritus and Rorty are correct, however, then it truly does not matter what you believe about the nature of reality and your place within it. You can go along for the ride on which your atoms are taking you, tear down your former atomistic-induced beliefs, and just go with the subatomic neurochemical flow in your brain. Those who reject the existence of God are not left with a variety of options in regards to understanding the nature of reality. For many who follow atomistic reductionism and postmodern skepticism to their logical conclusions, they are quickly faced with a gaping void of meaninglessness. Try as they might to fill it, the void stubbornly remains empty. Consider the thoughts of contemporary nihilist philosopher Alex Rosenberg, for example, from his book The Atheist's Guide to Reality. Though not a formal postmodernist philosopher, Rosenberg lays down the gauntlet about his views regarding the nature of reality having no ultimate objective meaning.
The first few pages of that are just a walking dictionary of nihilism. What is the meaning of life? There is no meaning of life. Well, how does language have meaning? It doesn't. I notice he's copyrighted his book, but he says language has no meaning.
Jana Harman, in her 2023 book, Atheists Finding God, Unlikely Stories of Conversion to Christianity in the Contemporary West, interviewed 50 former atheists about their coming to Christ, despite their avowed protestations against God and Christianity as atheists. One thing that attracted one particular atheist to Christianity while he was still an atheist was, quote, the truth of the claims being made and the veracity in which they stood up to scrutiny. To me, comfort or personal feelings were secondary to truth. I wanted and still want to believe that which is true, regardless of the personal implications. End quote. Another skeptic confessed similarly that, quote, I remembered thinking, if it is not true, then I don't want to believe it. If it is true, then there is something more to gain. End quote. The concept of truth, then, isn't just a mere collocation of atoms in our brains. It is not a matter of feelings or emotions or personal tastes, but something as objectively real and concrete as the sun, moon, and stars. Human beings have been created by God to understand and recognize that there is such a thing as truth, though that conviction has since been tainted by the fall in Eden. But there is one greater here among us today who has reversed the curse of Eden. One who is the ultimate embodiment of truth, our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who proclaims to us that he is, quote, the way, the truth, and the life, end quote. Even the most erudite postmodern philosophers, in the very act of denying the existence of truth, demonstrate its full-fledged reality and necessity for how we know, think, and communicate. This week and next, we will be chatting with philosopher Dr. Timothy McGrew and his daughter Beth L. about the historical and cultural strands of unbelief as it unfolded from the Greeks to the present day. Along the way, the McGrews give us some solid, thoughtful footholds that we may consider and employ in our conversations with skeptics and non-believers. As we begin part one, I asked him about Democritus and how his ideas were later received by other more widely known Greek thinkers. Here is Dr. Tim McGrew.
The works of Democritus actually were apparently a very thoroughgoing attempt to work out such a view, and Plato was unimpressed. In fact, Plato is reported to have said that if he could have collected all of the works of Democritus together and burned them, he would.
Mm.
So Plato, obviously preceding Christianity and as far as we can tell uninfluenced by Judaism, was nevertheless very disturbed by these atomists whose claim, as we see it filtered then down through to, say, the Roman poet Lucretius, is simply that everything that happens can be accounted for on the basis of just two things, atoms and empty space, atoms and void.
And the void.
And that's it. Everything else, and Epicurus will say very provocatively, including the soul, is explicable solely in terms of atoms and void.
Wow.
And so there's just nothing left over, no heel taps, nothing left that is unexplained. Those two things, properly understood, well, as Lucretius puts it, they will put the gods out of a job. So the idea was one of the first attempts to do a very bold reductionist move, to say everything is nothing but atoms and void. And the idea was that the appearance to the contrary is entirely a function of our ignorance. We don't see the causes of natural phenomena, so we ascribe them to the actions of the gods. We don't understand what causes earthquakes, so we wonder whether the gods are displeased and are doing this. But if only we understood, really understood, the scientific basis, as we would put it now, or the atomic basis of all of these things, we would see that there's nothing else to see here, and we can move along.
Right.
These aren't the droids you're looking for. You can move along, right? It's the Jedi mind trick thing that they're doing. And when you first become absorbed into that sort of worldview, whether it be ancient atomism or more modern scientistic versions of it, the effect is like the effect of a drug, because you feel like you've been given the key to everything. Suddenly you can explain everything, and if it's not explained by your principles, then it's not real. So you've got the passkey to reality. What is more intoxicating than that? That is tremendously strong. And so you see, historically, so many people, ancient times and modern times, falling into this almost Gnostic trap of saying, ah, the secret knowledge really is that it's just this simple.
Right, right. It seems that Faust seems to have at least wanted this, but he doesn't seem to be satisfied. Goethe has this, you know the story with Mephistopheles and wanting to know but not having enough time to to ingest the knowledge that would be required to know everything. But this, what you're saying, atoms in the void, seems to be lock and key, what satisfies a lot of people.
That's right.
In their unbelief, we can explain it all by physical causation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I was going to interject that. People like A.C. Grayling will get really annoyed when people like Tom Holland say that we owe the scientific revolution to Christians, because he'll be like, no, we don't. Look back at the ancient Greeks, you know. And so it is interesting to think about sort of two streams sort of motivating scientific inquiry. So you have the ancient Greeks who are like, well, let's figure out what's really causing thunder, causing this, that, and the other. But you have Christians who are like, I want to understand the mind of God. Let's go explore astronomy. And so you have sort of like two competing histories of science in that sense. I don't know if you want to respond to that.
Yeah, the Greek contribution was very great. What is curious is that the primary stream of Greek thought was not atomistic. The primary explanatory model that was offered comes from Aristotle, and it involves the various forms of causes. It involves the elements which are themselves in some not extremely well worked out way based on prime matter or unsigned matter. The medievals struggled mightily to try to figure out exactly how to cash that out. But basically, the Aristotelian model had it that the world is full up. There's no void anywhere. Things move out of each other's way, but there's always something there. Nature abhors a vacuum, so this whole idea of the void or the empty space, anathema to the primary stream of Greek thought.
Yeah.
The atomists were there, but they were never the dominant stream of thought until, very curiously, some Christians baptized Greek mm-hmm. atomism mm-hmm. said, we can see a version of this that is quite compatible with the idea of the existence of the soul, the existence of God as non-atomic things. Atomism provides us with an explanatory principle, but it is an explanatory principle only for the physical, and the physical isn't all there mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so people like Robert Boyle and Isaac Newton were able to give us a Christianized, baptized yeah. atomism, and they were following in the footsteps of people like Gassendi and even Galileo, mm-hmm. who were working with an atomic conception. So it's kind of curious that what was originally the Greeks' most direct attempt to give us an atheistic view of the world winds up having aspects that are picked up by the Christians in the scientific revolution, breaking with the main Aristotelian stream
of
Greek thought. So there's just curious interconnections all through here.
Yeah, I like what you said, Bethel, the two streams of thought in terms of how we look at science from the 21st century. And I can tell you as a bachelor, I abhor vacuuming too. You're supposed to laugh at that. No.
Do we tap the table now?
It's okay. But you look at Kepler and Tycho Brahe and Galileo and Newton. I mean, Kepler and Tycho were right on the verge. They were in both worlds. They had a world before the telescope and a world shortly after the telescope. And then you had the development of lenses and glass, and then the microscope comes along. And these two devices fundamentally change the way we look at nature. And this revolutionizes our thinking, our thoughts. Galileo's telescope, people thought it was cursed, right? People thought it was magic, and nobody wanted to look through it. Not nobody, but it certainly was changing the perspective of our universe. But the interesting thing about that technology is that initially you had to close one eye to see these things, whether it's microscopic or macroscopic. You had to close one eye, and I think there's something there to a kind of naturalistic worldview. When you have such stunning revelations from the magic glass, and you get these by closing one eye, I think there's a similarity there to closing one eye to the non-physical aspects of reality. And it seems like from Democritus and the atomists forward, there's this blind eye to the possibility of a non or an immaterial reality. You think that would be accurate?
I like the metaphor. I'll push it also in a different direction that I think is compatible with that, but kind of interesting. One of the things that people said when they looked through Galileo's telescope, saw what he told them they were going to see, but still denied that it was showing them the way that things were, was to say, it works wonders on the earth, but in the heavens, it deceives. And why did they say that? Well, here's a curious fact. When you took even Galileo's telescope and you pointed it at the stars, frequently you would point it at a star that you saw up there, look through the telescope, and you'd see two points of light, doubling, as they thought, the number of things that were actually there.
Mm.
And, of course, because I can look at the sky without the telescope and just see that there's only one star there,
Right. Clearly
it must be an artifact somehow of the technology. It must be that this is not actually the thing that's there. I must be seeing something false when I look through it. Now, from a contemporary perspective, we look at that and we say that that is some of the best evidence that Galileo made pretty good telescopes, because, in fact, most stars that we see in the sky are part of double star systems.
Right.
But the companion that we don't see is simply too faint to be made out with the naked eye.
Yeah.
So with a moderately good telescope, you will see two points of light, but that's because they're really there.
Mm-hmm.
Our own solar system, Jupiter, is a star that didn't make it. Increase its mass by a power of 10 and you'd have a little dirty yellow dwarf star or brown dwarf star there. But, you know, it didn't quite make it. Many stars do have less luminous companions. But notice what's happening then when you determine that what you are finding through the telescope can't be real. It's because what you saw without it wasn't that.
Mm.
And that then determines how you will interpret what you're seeing when you look through the lens.
Mm.
And this is a common human failing. We've already figured out what it's like. Then we go and look. either what we see is what we expected, in which case we say, but of course I told you so.
Right.
Or it's not what we expected, in which case we are superb at coming up with ways of explaining away what would otherwise be anomalous, discordant data.
Mm.
And so that is something Martin Horky wrote in a letter after he had been a guest at one of Galileo's stops where Galileo allowed people to look through his telescope. And Horky writes this very venomous and jealous little note saying that it deceives. He also says that at night when everyone was asleep, he snuck out and he took wax and he made an impression of the lenses of Galileo's telescope and he wants to make a better one. So this is clearly just a jealous rival.
Wow. Yeah.
But it's funny that he's saying in the heavens it deceives.
Mm.
Of course, you can't say that on Earth, right? What can you do with an experiment with a telescope? Well, you go stand at the far end of the room there and hold up a book. You pick a page. None of us can read it with our naked eyes from over here. Put a telescope to your eye, and yeah, it's upside down and backwards, but we can make out what's on the page, and we can read it. And clearly we're right, because we can just walk over to where you're standing
and see
the page
exactly.
Without the telescope. Can't do that with a star, so that gave him the space to insert the wedge and say, yeah, but not up there. Mm. Up there it doesn't work.
Mm.
And it's funny how many times we see people in all walks of life and for all kinds of reasons splitting themselves where they'll go reasonably a certain distance, but then not there, anything but that.
Yeah.
And they'll close it off. And
right.
So the history of astronomy is just one of many fields where we see that kind of mental move being played out.
Sure, sure. So predominantly in the West, is it primarily because of Christianity, or is this just what... I know that a lot of the Greek writings like Plato and Aristotle were preserved through Arabic scholars that was later rediscovered by Christians in the monasteries and copied and preserved that way. Do Plato and Aristotle survive into today because that was predominantly what the Arabs recovered? Or in Greek thought, were the atomists in the minority and the dominant thinking was either a Platonic or an Aristotelian cosmos?
Yeah, the Aristotelians dominated the landscape of Greek thought from early on. And Plato for the philosophical thought, but more Aristotle, not only in philosophy, but very much in what was called natural philosophy. We would now broadly call this science. So although there were people like Lucretius in On the Nature of Things, De Rerum Natura, who came along and gave voice to a a disenchanted world, a world with only atoms in void, still their position was a minority position, and that probably affected the overall amount of copying of manuscripts.
Mm.
When in the Renaissance Lucretius was rediscovered, there was exactly one manuscript of it that could be found, whereas you could find many manuscripts, maybe translated, maybe they'd gone from Greek into Persian, from Persian into Arabic, from Arabic into Spanish for use in Al-Andalus, right, in Moorish Spain, perhaps translated then from Spanish into Latin. One of the things that drove Thomas Aquinas crazy was bad translations of Aristotle. So I don't know how widely known this is among non-philosophers and non-historians, but Thomas actually commissioned a reader of Greek, William of Morbeck, to do very literal translations of Aristotle from rediscovered Greek manuscripts preserved by the Arabs directly into Latin.
Gotcha.
And this cleared up a lot of things. There's a funny telephone game-like thing that can happen when you take something in one language, translate it through a variety of different languages, and it comes out the far end. That can be quite confusing.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a good thing. But that was the dominant strand of Greek thought. So back to your question, well, you know, was it the Christians or was it the Arabs? The answer really has to be yes. It was both. The Christians wouldn't have had decent Greek manuscripts from which to work if the Arabs had not preserved them. If the Arabs alone had preserved them and the Christians had taken no interest, they would have fallen when the Arab libraries fell. That would not have been something that would have been picked up on and become fundamental.
So is it because of it was easily accommodated to a kind of theism that was found, that these were found worthy of preservation to the Christians especially, I'm thinking?
That's an interesting question. Thomas Aquinas would have said to you that what was important about Aristotle was that he got it right. He saw deeply. He had given an analysis that was compelling.
Right.
There are, as the adoption of baptized atomism shows, there were other ways of accommodating other views to a Judeo-Christian view.
Sure.
But Thomas was a very powerful and persuasive thinker. And so what Thomas did in giving us these things, Thomas basically made a case that was about as compelling as anything that was going at the time, that if you looked at philosophy this way, you would find that there was a sort of seamless continuity between good Christian theology, Aristotle's natural philosophy and his set of categories, and a certain measure of Neoplatonism as well. So blending all of those things together gave you the best philosophy recently rediscovered and the best theology. And so when you put it all together, you had the best of everything, and it seemed to make a coherent whole.
Right. And I think, Bethel, you're more in tune with the modern kind of atheist arguments that are out there. I've not nearly as widely as read as I'd like to be on the subject myself, but it seems that engaging with a lot of the contemporary atheist literature, they don't seem to focus on or take into consideration or deal with Aristotle or Plato to any extent, because I think, and check me if I'm wrong, if you think this has any merit, in modern atheism, I mean, you have an attempt at the synthesis of everything in neo-Darwinian evolution, but in the philosophical level, there seems to be a great lack of ontological and synthesis of all things like Aquinas attempted. Do you see this vacuity, or am I just seeing a shimmer of something? It just doesn't seem like the atheist rhetoric of contemporary time really deals in holistic concepts like Aristotle did.
My mom likes to say that if Aristotle had been around, he would have thought intelligent design research was super cool. he would have been all over it. Whoa.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Right.
Because, you know, Aristotle was just fascinated by that kind of stuff. You know, he loved observing, how these things, the inner workings. And so if he had been around during the Atomic Age, I think he would have been like a kid in a candy store. Just imagine Aristotle with a microscope. Wow.
Yeah. Right,
Could never get him out of the lab,
Absolutely.
Right, right.
Yeah, there's something, another dimension of this, though, regarding, especially, say, the new atheists. I'm thinking here of one of Richard Dawkins' debates with, I believe it was Rowan Williams.
Archbishop.
Right, the Anglican
Archbishop. Mm-hmm.
The debate was moderated, if I'm recalling, by Anthony Kenney, who is a philosopher.
Yes, yeah.
And at one point, Dawkins trotted out his simplicity argument, which is that, of course, it just pushes the problem further away if you're going to talk about a creator, because your creator is going to be then at least as complicated as the thing created and maybe more complex. And Dawkins was clearly very pleased with this. And then Kenny just asked him very coolly whether he meant simplicity of form or simplicity of function. And Dawkins couldn't track with the distinction. So Kenny went on. He said, a straight razor has great simplicity of form, but it can be put to many uses. It has a multiplicity of functions.
Mm,
mm. Whereas an electric razor has great complexity of form. Mm. The only thing you could do with it is to shave.
You can't chop chicken,
can't cut canvas, right? So did you mean simplicity of form or a function? Now, Kenny is a trained philosopher, and he's coming across this in Dawkins and just saying, okay, but which kind of simplicity did you have in mind? And it was an amusing moment, because it became obvious that Dawkins hadn't read, I won't even say deeply, but really at all, the literature on simplicity, divine simplicity, had probably a fine disdain for any of that, right? All of that is just measuring the exact length of the emperor's non-existent clothes.
A lot of atheists today will make that argument that philosophical discourse is cumbersome, unnecessary, word salad,
Right, you know. But Anthony Kenny is an agnostic.
Yeah.
He was not asking out of theological bias. Mm. He was asking out of a deeper appreciation of the philosophical sophistication of these discussions.
Mm.
And it just became painfully obvious that Dawkins was out of his depth on that.
Yeah.
That fact does not mean by
He's
itself
wrong.
That Dawkins is wrong about everything, yeah. but it was revealing, I think, in just the way that you're pointing out,
mm.
that there is this valuable heritage, even if we no longer try to cast our science in Aristotelian terms, even if we don't think that all of the four causes play the same roles that Aristotle thought mm-hmm. that they played, even if we have prioritized our search for efficient causes over everything else,
right.
maybe a little too much, maybe final causality should be brought back in there. That's that mm-hmm. teleology
mm-hmm.
thing.
The teleology
of it. But they haven't even appreciated the things that are part of the permanent heritage in philosophy. And it's difficult for someone who has disdain for everything except the bits he's studied
yeah.
to understand why other people are beginning to chuckle a little bit at
yeah.
his dismissal of it. And
right.
a fine chiseled profile and a British accent does not actually entitle you to dismiss everything.
Right, right. And it seems that that atheism today, that the only thing I can even conceive of that is even remotely close to the philosophical heritage of the Judeo-Christian West would be something like Darwinian evolution. Everything can be explained. It's like the modern atoms in the void argument in some sense, that everything can be explained either by science or the methods and tools of whatever natural selection has utilized. Do you see that? Do you guys see that? Like if the bigger picture is ever invoked, it's not philosophical, it's Darwinian. It seems to be the case.
Yeah, like a new totalizing.
Yes, exactly.
Theory of everything.
Yeah,
sure. I was also going to say that I think there's an assumption of empiricism. Like,
mm-hmm.
objective seems to be interchangeable with scientific. Like,
mm-hmm.
every time I hear people talk about it, like even people who might be friendly to Christianity otherwise, they kind of slip into this habit of, well, there's objective things over here, it's subjective things over there.
Mm.
And there's things that you can test, things that you can do experiments on, and blah, blah, blah. And it's the, you know, Francis Schaeffer's two stories.
Two stories, right.
Yeah.
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it seems that to formalize it in the 20th century up until the 1960s, logical positivism seemed to try to scientifically adduce what counts as knowledge and what doesn't, and it seemed to be based on the foundational assumption of empiricism. And it does seem to me, I don't know if you guys seem to be aware of it too, that there is the kind of assumption within Christianity sometimes of this dichotomous view of empirical, non-empirical, objective, subjective, that is more classified from modernity than it is from a rich theological tradition.
So this is kind of funny. So let's break this down a little bit, because I think that what we see behind it is, again, the power of a preconceived notion. You can detect, measure, record, replay the sound of a voice. That's easy. We're doing it right now. But when it comes to the question, why is there articulate discourse proceeding? Why are the sounds here actually making up words that are strung into sentences that are carrying meaning, that have relevance to the meanings of sentences said earlier? How is this all holding together like this? The obvious and untutored answer is, well, the speech is the product of a rational mind. Now, if you're in the grip of an ideology that says all the stuff there is physical, measurable stuff, then you have to push back the explanation and say, but that rational mind, in the end, that's just our modern version of
atoms in the void.
Atoms in the void. That is just something yeah. that arises. It is nothing but the outcome of a process. And then we give our little account of the evolutionary process. We say, well, blind variation with selective retention. We are taking information out of the environment and packing it into the genome, and we give little toy models of cases where that works, and we set up our assumptions to make it easy to see that at work.
Mm.
And then we gesture with varying degrees of savoir-faire toward much more complicated things than we say, and those, of course, are just sort of similarly disposed, rather in the way that the atomists looked at certain things and said, yeah, well, we can't take this down to the ground with you right now, but you should just accept our IOU. You should accept our promissory note, because after all, come on, it's a very simple picture, and we probably will come up with it eventually.
Simplicity, again.
Simplicity.
Yeah.
And this time, an epistemic sort of simplicity, like, if I had to make fewer assumptions than you did, then I win. And, of course, that's a wildly distorted way to do any kind of reasoning, because...
That's a Gramoppy makes that argument.
Yeah, except for this little bit that even Galileo pauses and talks about in his dialogues concerning the two chief world systems. One of the characters brings... up simplicity, like kind of an Occam's razor mm-hmm. thing, and the other one says, ah, but you have to explain things equally well, right?
Yeah.
So an example I like to use of this, and this one drawn from history, is can we say that simplicity is of overwhelming importance in history so that if you and I agree on the existence of all of the American presidents except Abraham Lincoln, you believe in Abraham Lincoln, but I don't. Can I look at you archly and say, well, you don't believe that I'm the president, or that Bethel is the president, or that, you know, pick Tom, Dick, and Harry, that right. they're the president. Some of us just believe in one president.
One less president than you.
Right. And, well, I mean, you've just made complete nonsense out of American history. Right.
right?
The
exactly.
entire latter half of the 19th century has just gone completely to pieces.
Yeah.
If Abraham Lincoln didn't exist, was it an android? Whoa. Now we're off in, like, Doctor Who territory.
Abraham Lincoln, vampire slayer.
That's it. You know, like absolutely. Yeah. And so... the requirement of simplicity, though a reasonable part of a nuanced package of methodologies for understanding the world, has to be balanced against explanatory power.
Mm.
And when we take just one thing like that, as philosophers in metaphysics are inclined to do, and we say, well, then, you know, if I have fewer things than you do, then all else being equal, which of course they are, I win. You know,
right,
it's right there in that slide in the, and of course, I can explain everything at least as well as you can. Can you, though?
Well, I always, I've heard the pushback on the simplicity from the atheist perspective. That whole argument is, well, to me, the Large Hadron Collider is not simple. What are we talking about in terms of the structural simplicity, the ontological simplicity? Is it just a quantitative simplicity? I just have one less argument to deal with than you. Is that
one less entity?
Yeah.
Or perhaps entity type.
So it's Occam's razor used.
It is an Occam's razor used, but the point that I'm making in the Lincoln example is in ordinary examples, we always look to say, yes, but you have to still be able to do the explanatory work.
Yes, yeah.
And that's the point at which... we hear a lot about how much simpler the view is, and a lot of hand-waving takes place when we ask for the details about how exactly the explanatory work is done. I think the Darwinism example is an interesting place to do this. There are absolutely deep, serious questions as to how various kinds of biochemical systems could, within the lifespan of the universe, have arisen. Eugene Koonin's got a book called Logic of Chance in which he delves into this. And in the end, quite stunningly, this bioinformatics specialist just punts to a multiverse.
Well, wow,
let's give us
really?
10 to the 100 or so,
really?
You know, power additional universes.
Wow.
And that'll give us a lot more space to, and then maybe the probabilistic problems can be tractable,
invoke
some kind of anthropic principle, and there we are.
Wow.
And I've heard other people, I've heard very well-known Nobel Prize-winning physicists do this, and the trouble with this is that if that kind of a move were seriously and consistently to be invoked, it would also absolutely destroy things that they don't want destroyed. So you're looking at that and you're saying, hey, let's just say we can have all these multiverses, and then here we have a universe, and sure, it would look, if this were the only universe, like this was a designed thing, but you know what? There's so much probabilistic space out there. There are so many
right.
probabilistic resources that somewhere we'd have found one like this anyway. But you can then apply that in very inconvenient ways.
Yeah.
Let's take this argument and run with it. In that case, the one I heard, somebody said not just, you know, 10 to the hundredth power, but no, infinitely many universes.
Mm-hmm.
To which I responded, then there are infinitely many universes, by your reckoning, in which all of the evidence is as it appears to us now, and yet we are absolutely wrong in all of our scientific beliefs.
Right.
And how do you know we're not in one of those?
Right. Leonard Susskind, a Stanford physicist professor, made an argument in 2009, speaking publicly in the Bay Area. He said that everything that has happened, everything that can happen, has happened. A riff on the multiverse. That if many worlds and Hugh Everett is true, or if multiverse theory is true, you and we three are having a conversation in a different universe talking about completely different things. There's just a multitude of possibilities that never functionally have no end.
There are conversations where our doppelgangers in those universes are saying all of the same words that we're saying with the same intonations, but are privately thinking this is all a hoax. Right. Aren't we clever in perpetrating it?
And we think that lest this sounds science fiction, Max Tegmark, an MIT physicist, and Sean Carroll, both take seriously I think Sean Carroll is a proponent of the Hugh Everett many worlds interpretation, but he says, don't worry about the metaphysics of many yous out there. The math works here. Max Tegmark, kind of a multi-universe, our universe is mathematical. He postulates a whole chapter about what his life was like in another universe where he almost gets hit by a train, and then other universes where he does get hit by a train, and so he's simultaneously alive and dead, and he's seriously thinking about the implications of this. It just seems like that what is becoming, what would have been, I think, maybe even to Aristotle, just seems to be today so taken for granted. It just doesn't, how has such science fiction, if you will, about multiverses and many selves and doppelgangers, how have we gotten to the point where this is taken as almost sacrosanct science?
Right.
Well, how has this happened?
If you need to go there or otherwise you're having trouble reconciling the views that you already know you're committed to holding with the evidence that's there under your nose, then there's a powerful motivation to take that exit ramp, take any way out you can.
Mm.
And if that's where it's going to lead you, then that's where you will go. I made a comment in one of my talks, the plenary talk that I gave this morning here at the Defend Conference, that back in the 1960s, John Warwick Montgomery and Afram Stroll had a debate at the University of British Columbia. Montgomery pointed out that if Stroll was going to be skeptical about the Gospels, the very criteria he was himself invoking would lead him to throw out virtually all of ancient history as well. To which Stroll responded, well, okay then, I will.
Oh,
and his colleagues, who was either in classics or in history, I'm not quite sure which, was sitting in the front row and said, good God, Avram, not that! But that was where he went, because he was in the grip of a very powerful ideology that said, whatever I've got to do to maintain the position that I've already decided I'm going to maintain, I will. And the funny thing is, this is not sort of a feature only of the uneducated or unintelligent people.
Mm.
The more educated, the more intelligent we are, frequently the more adroit we are at finding rationalizations for not changing our minds.
And making them sound intelligible. And
very sophisticated, and of course this was just what any reasonable person would do.
Right.
And this is not a problem that is unique to atheists and agnostics.
No.
It's a problem that Christians suffer with too. It's a human problem.
Right.
And so one of the things that's useful to do for all of us is to explore strategies for changing our minds, perhaps gradually and incrementally, but not turning a blind eye to things that don't comport well.
Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him." Jesus therefore was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Jesus said to him, "I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." This is Apologetics Profile, a weekly podcast equipping you to engage the world of non-Christian ideas beliefs, and spiritual practices. Apologetics Profile is a production of Watchman Fellowship, Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on apologetics, cults, world religions, and other non-Christian ideologies and practices, visit watchman.org today. That's watchman.org.